Welcome to Reclaiming the Republic. This show is sponsored by ReclaimingTheRepublic.org. I am G.R. Mobley. This is an educational grassroots program focused on uniting and leading in restoring the Republic and placing the federal government back into the scope and framework of the Constitution once again.
And welcome back. And it is now or never. And that debt is fraud. And we're really kind of close to wrapping up the Pennsylvania debates. And so we've got a few things to go through. I am opting not to cover the amendments because there are some really good amendments that I would recommend everybody go through. But amendments are really just kind of giving you what they would like to see. What's really important is how each line or clause, when they're talking, sometimes, it's, you know, like with Wilson, he talks a lot about his conjecture of the compact. We've covered all these things. But that has no bearing on what the necessary and proper clause means. It's just his idea that it's really not a compact. And so, like I said, he's an outlier that doesn't really bear hardly any weight on the veracity of what he's saying in defining the clauses of the Constitution as he's going through it and helping explain, clarify, stipulate their meanings. So anyway, so we're at that point where we've actually got McLean kind of talking at the very end here. But before we get into the Pennsylvania debates, and before we get into a kind of a, not a go back, but kind of an interesting conversation, I need to help emphasize that until we actually start holding our public servants accountable, nothing's going to change. As long as they know they can get away with murder, people are going to die. As long as they know that they can make themselves rich, they're going to take your money. These are the people that are in the position that can do those things. And this is why the Constitution was framed the way it was, so that they just couldn't do anything that they wanted to do. They could only do the things that we delegated in that Constitution to do. Period. And so it literally, I mean, everything has been turned up sideways because we are no longer a Republican form of government that is living within the framework, within the literal enumerations of the Constitution. They've wandered so far out of that. And over the past year, over the past years I've been on this radio, I've been proving and helping you understand that we're more of a judiciary form of government than anything else. So all of that, I cannot forget to help emphasize that compliance of the Constitution and finding champions in office, getting champions in office to call for full compliance and call others out for their failure to support the Constitution and demand all others rise up and start holding each other accountable. What a great problem that is when we have public service saying, no, I did something wrong. You need to hold me accountable. It's almost like that little child that, you know, happened to pick something up, put it in their pocket, and realize that they stole something when they walked out of the store and said, Mommy, I stole this. I feel bad. And teaching that child to take that back in, and then hopefully it becomes a very positive experience. I mean, the worst thing that can happen is that the store owner, the proprietor, basically starts yelling and saying, I ought to have you arrested, or, you know, making it a real bad experience. Because we should reward people when they do good. Even if they've done the wrong thing, when they say, I'm sorry, we should forgive them. We should let, you know, those things go so that that person is reinforced. We're helping reinforce the idea of doing good. We don't want to punish people because they did how many times have you gone through something and say, wow, I'm really sorry I was honest and said something to you? You never would have known had I not told you. And so this is how we become jaded. This is how we become apathetic. So just remember that Jerry Wistrand is in Missouri running a campaign. He's out there calling on people to make him accountable. Put me in office so I can be held accountable to you. Because my job, technically, is to be accountable to the Constitution, and that's how you hold me accountable. Because that piece of paper doesn't hold them accountable. We're accountable to our constituents, and if our constituents call us out, then they can be accountable. So, that all being said, I'm ready to gear up and hit the Pennsylvania debates, but before we do, Sean proposed a very important, provided some very important insight or information that I think we need to really put it out here, because I'm not ready to dive into the details, but I can just tell you from what we're going to hear there's some problems here. Anyway, Sean, you were talking about some case or something. Go ahead.
No, I was just saying that in research I found in a Trump v. Anderson Supreme Court decision in 2024 when Colorado was trying to remove Trump from the ballot, the Supreme Court unanimously ruled that states cannot enforce Section 3 of the 14th Amendment against federal office holders or candidates, particularly the president. The court held that only Congress, not individual states, has the authority to enforce disqualification for federal offices through legislation.
Okay, so I'm going to go through that because I want to hear because that sounds like it's a summary of, you know, higher level, what have you. So I want to go through that, but on the face of it, Section 3 of the 14th Amendment does not apply to the president at all. It does not list the president as an office. It actually goes twice over who these people are to be held accountable, who the people are to be held accountable. It doesn't say that Congress is the enforcer of it. What it does say is only Congress, only both houses of Congress, can remove the disability. When it comes to enforcing the Constitution, the states being the parties to it actually can. The state of Colorado trying to remove Trump because of Section 3 of the 14th Amendment is their justification. They should have been slapped, you know, quickly right to their butt to say, where does this list the president? This only lists senators, representatives, judges, governors, you know, state legislatures, people in state and local offices. It omits the president because the process of impeachment is clear. When a sitting president is to be charged or somebody that has served before, now it's one thing if it was Governor Trump and he violated the Constitution, then you would actually have to go and create that disability. In other words, all you have to do is create the case to say, because he did these things, he should no longer be eligible to be in any office, and we're keeping, and you could withhold him that way. But he was a sitting president when he did what you didn't like, and therefore you can't apply Section 3 to a president. And because they went through the impeachment process and he wasn't found guilty, you can't apply that. Does that make sense?
Oh, yeah. That makes sense.
Yeah, and so
I understand that, but
the way the
what
court,
I'm talking about is, yeah, what the Supreme Court decided, that only that the states cannot remove people from federal office.
Absolutely wrong. So I get that. And the Supreme Court has said that. But many things that the Supreme Court says is only goes to prove that the Supreme Court is protecting the status quo and the power of the federal government when the federal government has no power. They only have, well, actually, they have those powers delegated, but that power is to serve the states for the state's purpose by the state's design. The states actually have all the power and all the control over the federal government. And we go through this with the Madison's, you know, resolutions and so forth, where he literally spells it out. The problem is that you can get probably 100 judges that will all agree that we're the all powerful, that states are nothing and states can't do anything. That doesn't make it so. That what they're trying to do is they're trying to redefine the law. They're trying to empower themselves, and Madison even warned about that in his report on the Virginia Resolution, saying that if the judiciary can do that, it becomes applicable even to the president and to Congress, that when they start diving into things that they have no jurisdiction, they start doing, you know, end runs to protect themselves, just like this, then what they're all they're doing is a redefining the Constitution. The only thing that they can do is they can go back to the states. But they don't do that. They're not doing what they're supposed to do. This goes down this idea of what we've talked about, while the courts really don't represent the Constitution and the Union. The courts represent this progressive idea of this all central powered federation and this federal government that has all powers over all things. Sorry, that's not what we have as a government. There's never been an amendment to grant those types of powers. Those are all illegitimate assertions. So I believe that almost every time the Supreme Court is going to open its mouth, it is going to babble about how great they are and how they're above everybody, that they'll never, never acknowledge that their power is so limited that it's only over these very few objects that are enumerated. They're not going to do that because right now they've got everybody bamboozled, bringing everything to them, and they're being treated like gods. And the only way these things change is, as I started this show off, when we the people start holding our public servants accountable, when we actually start demanding that our legislatures start reeling in and controlling our judiciary, and that the legislatures actually start fixing these problems. At this county level, the county legislators should be controlling, removing, and cleaning up that state government. And the state governments need to be removing and cleaning up and getting rid of this refuge and this rotting cancer in our federal government. I mean, the rot and cancer is in every state. And we've got to get this stuff under control. The only way this can happen is when we start demanding full compliance. I'll probably be dying saying that, you know. And maybe America will get there. GR can't do it. The president can't do it. The Supreme Court can't do it. We know they won't do it. We know that the president won't do it. So who's going to do it? That leaves you. You and me. We have to do it. Period. So anyway, I'll look up the actual arguments in the case of what they're trying to assert, because there's no doubt, and what the court should have said, because it's not that the court was wrong in their ruling, but what they were, because this is the interesting thing. The ruling was correct. They cannot remove him. They can't apply Section 3 of the 14th Amendment to the president for anything that the president has done. But what they did was they expanded it. And they expanded it well beyond how it was defined and well beyond the language of Section 3 of the 14th Amendment. The only thing Congress can do that is specific for Congress in Section 3 is they're the only ones that can remove the disability once somebody has been beaten with the ugly stick. You can't serve anymore. You're ugly. Dumb. There you go. So now, the only way that marking of the ugly stick gets wiped off is both houses of Congress. Two-thirds of both houses of Congress have to vote to remove that disability. The interesting thing, and I help people understand this, is when you start removing members of Congress, and we get, you know, quite a few of these members of Congress removed that are problematic, you're actually going to be shifting the balance within Congress to where you won't get two-thirds of Congress to say, yeah, let those poor saps back in, because those new guys coming in are going to want to protect themselves, right? They don't want to give up their job just because Congress removed the disability. So for the most part, it's almost a dead letter, I see. We've got to start working it, though, because who knows? Maybe down the road there may actually be, you know, some forgiveness or what have you. But right now, everybody seems to have this scorched earth attitude, right? Anyway, let's look, because I think where we were left off, and I think you're the one that said, hey, we don't have enough time. We started going into the enumerated powers, right?
Yes, sir, Mr. McKean.
Yep.
and enumerated.
The framers of this Constitution, right at that point. I think that's where we left off. So I think we've got enough time to, because these are kind of long paragraphs, but let's dive into this, because I appreciate Mr. McKean, because he doesn't necessarily have this axe to grind of we the people and so forth that Wilson tends to do. But let's go ahead. Thanks.
The framers of this Constitution wisely divided the legislative department between the two houses, subject to the qualified negative of the President of the United States, though this government embraces only enumerated powers. In a single state, annual elections may be proper, the more so when the legislative powers extend to all cases. But in such an extent of country as the United States, and when the powers are circumscribed, there is not the necessity, nor are the objects of the general government of that nature as to be acquired immediately by every capacity. To combine the various interests of 13 different states requires more extensive knowledge than is necessary for the legislature of any one of them. 2 years are therefore little enough for the members of the House of Representatives to make themselves fully acquainted with the views, the habits, and interests of the United States. With respect to the Senate, when we consider the trust reposed in them, we cannot hesitate to pronounce that the period assigned to them is short enough. They possess, in common with the House of Representatives, legislative power. With its concurrence, they also have power to declare war. They are joined with the President in concluding treaties. It therefore behooves them to be conversant with the politics of the nations of the world and the dispositions of the sovereigns and their ministers. This requires much reading and attention. And believe me, the longer a man bends his study to any particular subject, the more likely he is to be a master of it. Experience and practice will assist genius and education. I therefore think the time allowed under this system to both houses to be extremely proper. This objection has been made repeatedly, but it can only have weight with those who are not at the pains of thinking on the subject. When anything, sir, new or great, is done, it is very apt to create a ferment among those out of doors, who, as they cannot always enter into the depth and wisdom of counsels, are too apt to censure what they do not understand. Upon a little reflection and experience, the people often find that to be a singular blessing, which at first they deemed a curse.
Okay, so
second.
So that's kind of a mouthful. And you didn't realize he was doing first, second, third, right? Because he's kind of listing off on these enumerations of these points. I find it interesting when he says, believe me, the longer a man bends his study to any particular subject, the more likely he is to be master of it. Experience and practice will assist genius and education. What we do here, folks, by reading this and offering this to you, giving you these documents, so that you can sit down and read these words too. When you sit down and read these words along with Sean, myself, Tammy, whomever's reading at the time, if you're reading the words, you're hearing the words, this etches them deeper into your head and into your heart. This is the only way people can actually stand up and say, I know for a fact this is what Madison said. If not, you're just getting up and saying, GR told me Madison said this. There's a huge difference. A huge difference. Now, nobody would actually say GR told me, but people would say, well, where did you get that? Cite this, you know, what paragraph? What document? What day? Give me the details of the citation. And if you can't do that, you just kind of know you're just paraphrasing editorials. That's all. And that, at the end of the day, can be exploited by, I'll just say, those dark, evil lawyers who are literally doing everything they can to pick the skin off of good people. So go ahead. Let's dive into second.
Second, quote, that one representative for 30,000 persons is too few. There will be, sir, 65 in the House of Representatives and 26 in the Senate, in all 91. who, together with the president, are to make laws into several particular matters entrusted to them, and which are all enumerated and expressed. I think the number is sufficient at present, and in 3 years' time, when a census or actual enumeration must take place, they will be increased, and in less than 25 years, they will be more than double. With respect to this, different gentlemen in the several states will differ, and at least the opinion of the majority must govern.
Let me say this, because when you look at this point in time, this is still in 1787. In other words, they're already talking about the need of changing representation. The real thing that I've noticed is I don't think anybody ever really put their arms around it. When they say 30,000 persons, does that include children? If it does include children, then I don't think that number is too big. Because children really don't have representation. They're just calculated in that number for representation, apportionment, taxation, those types of things. Who actually has representation? So when you take your pool of people, who are the voters? Because really, it's those who are legitimately constituents. It's the head of the household. Back in those days, how many heads of households were made up that 30,000? Because those were the people that could petition you, that really were your constituents. Does that make sense?
Yes, sir.
And so, as we look today, because I think that that's the conversation that we need to talk about when we talk about what is relative, because you can live in an area where the average household has no children. I can think of a couple of areas where you could go and you could find a congressional district where you're going to be very dense population of constituents. Arizona, Florida, right? Where, you know, the retirement communities, where they don't have a bunch of kids, but everybody there is a voter, and everybody there should have voice and representation. And I think that we really need to, this is maybe a 21st century paradigm, because they were just trying to, you know, make sure the masses of the people. I honestly believe that the people that actually have a right to representation, that's the measure of what we should be looking at fairly, because in Arizona, they're underrepresented. And in worst places where you have a lot of, you know, youth and, you know, regular families and so forth. So in those areas, you would probably find that you have maybe 2-to-1 in difference, because you have far more kids in those households. And that actually skews representation to, you know, giving the younger average age. When the average age goes down, then you're going to find that those voters in that area have extra representation. Now, the Supreme Court played around with this whole idea of the, you know, one person, one vote, equalizing representation. The Constitution of the United States dictated very specifically that, you know, the representation was set at 30,000, and still is. I believe that that needs to be really scrubbed, and I believe that we really need to look at it, because back in their day, they couldn't fathom the ability of maintaining data of, you know, when children became voters and so forth, how, you know, we could literally track the ages and the people, the constituents, to ensure that the congressional districts were appropriately assigned and or adjusted as those demographics changed. Back in those days, it was just basic census. And they didn't have the ability to track all of that stuff. To me, it's easy, very easy to do. And so when we come back, I'd like to get Sean's thoughts and ideas on this, because when we're talking about our government and we're talking about a Republican form of government, there is nothing more important than understanding how we have appropriate representation and making sure that we have appropriate representation. We'll be right back after this.
If you've listened to my show, Reclaiming the Republic, then you should understand that the Constitution is neither a living document nor a noble guide to governance. In accordance to Article 7, the Constitution is a hard, fast contract, and the states are the only stakeholders in this contract. Integral in contract law, the stakeholders or states possess the inherent authority to exercise oversight and enforcement over their contract. This means they can audit the federal government by the contract, and with republic review, they can enforce compliance to their constitution. Any single state can perform the audit, but when states begin to unite in the auditing process, this is what is referred to as republic review. Please read my argument for republic review as well as my description of the republic review model on reclaimingtherepublic.org. We even have a graphic flowchart that shows you how republic review works. If you want to learn more, contact me on Facebook or send me an email. Thank you. As a reminder, if you have any questions or comments, we have a 24-hour comment line, 425-270-5416.
Well, so, Sean, we've talked about this before. Perfect representation is one-to-one, but that is completely, you know, that turns us into a pure democracy, as well as it ties everybody into, you know, being a part of government. And, you know, we just can't sustain ourselves that way, you know. So how do we do this? Well, we need to come up with this number. And they came up with 40,000. They ended up coming up with 40. Washington, going through the convention, we saw that Washington said, I think that number's too high. So they made a motion that it be 30,000. They agreed quickly, boom, done. Now it's 30,000. But they really didn't, and at that point in time, it wasn't something that was within their grasp, because they were just kind of keeping things at a high level. Today, I honestly think that if there's an open and honest discussion, it wouldn't take long for people to kind of realize that this should, you know, the apportionment should go down the path of voters, of those people, legitimate citizens who have, you know, good citizen status where they can vote. If you're a criminal, then boom, no. Right? Does that make sense? Because we're talking about representation when your representative should be, you know, available to you. You shouldn't necessarily be available to the 8-year-old child or those types of things. So what do you think?
I somewhat agree. I think that there needs to be taken into account. We talked about this before. People who don't own property should not be voting on property tax related issues.
Right.
Oh, because they're going to, you know, vote for their own whatever it is. They have no dog in the fight. So, I mean, I think that needs to be taken into consideration. And I also think that it needs to be like you're talking about. If you have a certain qualification, and it's not that your children are going to lose representation, or if your wife is a homemaker that she's going to lose representation. If you're living that according to that paradigm, then you have representation in the head of the household. So I think that, and I think with the technology and different ways we have of determining and vetting these things, that there needs to be some kind of adjustment to those kind of issues. I'm not exactly sure what it is right off the cuff.
Right, right.
But I know that it's not right for people who can't be drafted to go to war to be able to vote for people who will take them to war.
Right.
Take the other people to war who
right.
can be drafted to go to war.
I get it. Okay, so I agree with you that this would be expanded into all things of suffrage. Who and what do you have a right of suffrage? If you're a property owner, you should have a right of suffrage over property taxes. That's different than representation. But if you are a voter and you are voting for a representative who is a legislator who can create laws that affects everybody, then all voters should be able to vote for their representation. So you're right. And I think we talked about this, where it we need to have this discussion. And the only way that we're going to start moving in the right direction is through these, I'll call them these constitutional compliance committees, as we start putting these at the county level and at the state level. Then the states can start actually talking county to county, or I should say committee to committee, and actually create dialogue so that eventually they can come up with, instead of having a convention, remember we keep on talking about having this constitutional convention, how can we improve the Constitution, and how it, nine times out of ten, it does come from the states. Well, there's no reason why the states can't actually articulate and even create an amendment to change this apportionment to clearly define and delineate how, what, and, you know, get it right down so nothing more, nothing less. This is what, you know, these are the people who will be apportioned or who have representation, blah, blah, blah. I mean, there's no reason why we can't be doing these things. This is how, your legislators should be serving you to ensure that they're actually serving you. But
also, there should be service to the country. And I'm not talking about like some fascist type of required military service. If we have the militia system, then all able-bodied men are expected and obligated to be trained and disciplined in defending their communities, defending their country.
Completely.
And if you can't do that, or you refuse to do that, then why should you be given representation in the nation where you refuse to serve?
Excellent. Because I truly believe that that's something else that actually starts needing to grow legs, that we start challenging these concepts of mercenary forces, that everybody gets moved back into, we're all civilians, and we're all the militia, and we all have a responsibility because it's a nation of laws, and we believe and live here because we love the rule of law. Those people who do not love the rule of law, who want to make it up as they go along, want to change the law, want to, you know, basically subjugate people, all of the, you know, all these leftists, these communists, take from those who have and give to those who have not. All of them should be stripped of their citizenship. They're not there to support the Constitution and live the rule of law. They're doing everything they can to undermine it. And these things will actually, I believe that we're at a conscious level today. We're capable of understanding and seeing these things, especially when all of a sudden we're examining them right there on the table. We can see how Democrats aren't really citizens of the United States. They're insurgents. Most all of them, most, I shouldn't say most, a good percentage of them. I do believe that there's just people that are Democrats, they vote Democrat, and it's probably the majority of them, probably, that they're clueless. And they just vote Democrat because it's been a family thing. And they spend no time understanding or getting involved. Well, those people, I think they can become inhabitants. You want to be a participant in this society, you want to be a participant in government, then you need to actually understand you have responsibilities. You've got to, you know, be a part of the militia. You got to do these things, whether you like it or not. You have a conscientious objection, that's fine. We won't put the gun in your hands. We'll put, you know, a little first aid kit and band-aids on your hip, whatever. Right. Or a cook. Yeah. Anyway, good. So they're bringing this up prior to the end of 1787. And I want to point that out, because when we look at the amendments, I pointed this out yesterday, that all that time of the proceedings of the, what was this again? The proceedings of the meeting at Harrisburg in Pennsylvania, this happened about a year later. So as we're looking at the representation and the enumerations and all of these different things, all of this was done prior to the conclusion of the 1787 convention in Pennsylvania. So they were the first ones coming up with these ideas of amendments. I made this assertion before that Massachusetts got the credit for it, but I believe when we read Pennsylvania, that's what they're doing right here. Then they're, and if you look at these, these are recommendations. Like the next one, third, quote, the senator shall share in the appointment, quote, and close quote. So these are recommendations that they're trying to put in and or challenging existing language. So let's go ahead and go to the third one.
Quote, the senators have a share in the appointment of certain officers and are to be the judges on the impeachment of such officers. This is blending the executive with the legislative and judicial department and is likely to screen the offenders impeached because of the concurrence of majority of the Senate in their appointment. The okay. president is to nominate to office and, with the advice and consent of the Senate, appoint officers so that he is the responsible person. And when any such impeachment shall be tried, it is more than probable that not one of the Senate who concurred in the appointment will be a senator, for the seats of a third part are to be vacated every 2 years, and of all in six. As to the senators having a share in the executive power, so far as to the appointment of certain officers, I do not know where this restraint on the president could be more safely lodged. Some may think a privy counselor might have been chosen by every state, but this could little amend the matter, if any, and it would be a considerable additional expense to the people. Nor need the Senate be under any necessity of sitting constantly, as has been alleged, for there is an express provision made to enable the president to fill up all vacancies that may happen during their recess, the commissions to expire at the end of the next session. As to the impeachments, the objection is much stronger against the Supreme Executive Council of Pennsylvania. The House of Lords in Great Britain are judges in the last resort in all civil causes, and besides had the power of trying impeachment. On the trial of impeachments, the senators are to be under the sanction of an oath of affirmation, besides the other ties upon them to do justice, and the basis is more likely to be against the officer accused than in his favor, for there are always more persons disobliged than the contrary when an office is given away, and the expectants of office are more numerous than the possessors.
Okay, so, all right, these are excellent points, but I don't want to expound on any of these. Let's get into the election.
I would like to.
Go ahead.
Because we have a situation going on right now.
Okay.
Where President Trump has a whole bunch of people that he's nominated for offices, and the Senate refuses to bring them up for approval. And he can't do recess appointments because they keep doing pro forma sessions to keep the Senate in session, so he can't do recess appointments.
Okay, so
the Senate is actually manipulating the executive branch at this very moment.
You know, I'm glad you're bringing this up, because what is the solution?
The solution is to, I don't know. I haven't really delved into it that deeply, and I don't know the Senate rules of how they even are able to do that. But it sounds just totally illegitimate to me. I don't understand.
Yeah, so
that's another thing that puzzles me, is the House and the Senate both have their own rules.
Mm-hmm.
And it says in the Constitution they're allowed to make up their rules. But how can they make up rules that totally violate the Constitution or subvert the Constitution, and
so
those still be valid rules?
Okay, so let's be clear. The Senate, the senators in the Senate, and representatives in the House are not dukes and princes, duchesses and princesses. They are servants. They are there to provide suffrage for their constituent. Now, you brought up the Senate, and the Senate has a job to do for their constituents. Who is their constituents?
The states.
What do you mean, the states?
The people of the states.
Nope.
Now,
they're there to provide suffrage for whom? The state legislators.
I understand that technically is
okay.
the way it should be, but
mm-hmm.
that is not the way that it is done.
Right, but
every court in the land has.
Yeah, but if you want to solve the problem, mm-hmm. the solving of the problem is really easy. if we all of a sudden we help everybody understand that the state legislatures should be demanding that these guys do their job. Because when the state legislatures start demanding, guess what? Then the states can actually say, we're removing you for Section 3 of the 14th Amendment, and we don't give a crap what the Supreme Court just said. And then they will absolutely replace that person as well. And when it comes down to that person trying to be on the ballot, let's see the Supreme Court try to print that name on the ballot in that state. I understand that with the president, it could have easily gone down the same thing as nullifying and resisting and so forth. But literally, when the state legislatures start doing their job and hold the leader of the Senate, it was a Thune, right?
Yes, sir.
Okay. So whatever state that he's from,
I think it's
Indiana?
Dakotas.
Oh, one of the Dakotas. Dakota. Okay. Well, so
I'm not sure which.
Somewhere in the Midwest. Then if they actually started saying, look, you know, we want you to get these judges passed through. We want this done. We want this done. We want this done. This goes back to the SAVE Act as well. Everybody wants to see these things being done. Well, it's the state legislatures that should be calling them up and saying, look, but we have to help the state legislatures understand that they're there. Those senators are there as a proxy for you. That they are to give you your suffrage for you in everything that they do, whether it be judge appointments, whether it be for treaties, whether it be for legislation. Doesn't matter. You're to be guiding them and telling them how you want them to vote. And if they're not voting and doing what you want them to do, then you need to charge them for failing to give you your suffrage. And there you go. Bring them back. And the surefire way to avoid the courts, because I said this before, I know that the Supreme Court, they're all going to go into protective mode. So all you've got to do in your state constitution is basically create a state Trump on it, where you're no longer, you know, relying on the U.S. Constitution. You've put in your constitution that same accountability, that now you have the ability to enforce it with a felony. And the first thing that you do is they get removed from office and they go to jail. And so it's not, you're not trying them for treason, but you're trying them for violating their oath. And then the Supreme Court will try, and they'll try to get it up to the Supreme Court. By that point in time, the person's been replaced.
Yeah, that's what happened with the guy in Colorado or New Mexico that they tried to use Amendment 14, Section 3, Cawthorn.
And
he lost his race before it went through. So
right,
it was like void.
So. And so when the states get serious about actually enforcing this, Congress and the court can't come in and say, you have to vote for these guys. This is not right. You have to vote for them. No, I mean, when you all of a sudden, everybody starts realizing where the tyranny is coming from. And it's coming from the courts primarily. I mean, they're all doing their own little job of not doing their job and protecting each other from not doing their job to maintain the status quo. So you're right. This is a good it's a good point to bring up. I thought that I brought up the truth about the 17th Amendment and getting state legislatures to actually do their job and take control of that. Enough over the past few months and year, or what have you, but I appreciate you bringing that up and making that perfect segue to say, folks, go read that document. Go read that 5-page argument of how your state legislatures still have a right of suffrage, that those U.S. senators in that U.S. Senate are denying them, and they're serving the globalists. They say, oh, well, we're serving the people. We'll prove that. And actually, that's even not their responsibility. More importantly, they're supposed to be serving the state legislatures because the 17th Amendment never changed who their constituent was. And if you don't know, because, oh, well, it says it's the state, no. Go back into the Constitutional Convention, and it was very, very specific that this was the state legislature's suffrage in the Senate and the people's suffrage was in the House. They were not the same. So that doesn't mean that the people get double suffrage now. They still have their suffrage in the House, and the state legislature actually still has their suffrage in the Senate. And the 17th Amendment didn't do what apparently it's been doing, because everybody has just allowed the sleight of hand to just confuse them, and they go, well, what do we do now? Well, you tell them what you want. If they don't do it, remove them. Remove them.
I have a question on that, because when you, it sounds kind of like semantics, because the states still have their suffrage.
Where?
It doesn't say in that Constitution state legislatures.
Ah.
It says states.
Okay, so that's why.
So all they did was change who chose the senators.
So is that
the senators still from those states?
Hold on here.
So
this is easy, because I go through this all the time, Sean. When it comes down to understanding a line in the this compact, we're trying to understand what they mean by that state suffrage. Where do you go to find that? Either you go to the ratification debates where they clarify, if it was clarified there. But if it wasn't clarified there, then the only other document you can go to is the notes on the convention. This is where they actually documented what and why they were doing these things. This was the event itself. When you look at what is considered legal standing for establishing the meaning of words in a contract, you know, it never goes up to interpretation. Never. It always goes down to these fundamental primary documents, these primary source documents. First and foremost is the ratification. How was it described in that process? If it wasn't described, then you got to go to the creation of the compact. And was there language and debates on that? And absolutely there was from the very, very beginning. The state legislature wanted to maintain their suffrage just like they had in Continental Congress, that it would be equal. Remember, we kind of covered this, even in these ratification debates, that if one state may have six and another state may have two as far as representatives of Continental Congress, but they all had only one vote. It was a delegation, so the state was just sending more employees to get, you know, Continental Congress work done, but each state had equal representation, and that was something that they closely guarded, which is why in Article 5, they said, we want to make sure that an amendment will never take our suffrage away from us. And so when you see state, that is just shorthand for the state legislatures, because that's exactly who they kept referring to each time. It was the state legislatures for the Senate. Does that make sense? So
I understand what you're saying.
Okay.
But what I'm saying is, I don't see why didn't they put that in the amendment? First of all, why was the 7th Amendment passed? Because we talked about how the states wanted it passed. Why would they want to give up their suffrage to the people instead of the legislature?
The state legislatures didn't see it as giving up their suffrage. It was only a change of getting because there were a few of these states that were refusing to seat. They wanted to get the full quorum so that the Senate could do its job. And so they said, okay, if the state legislatures won't appoint, then we'll allow the people to select who is going to basically represent the state legislature. The language never changed that. But because they didn't emphasize, and everybody presumed that, oh, this means that they're representing the people now. No, it didn't. To actually change who they represent, you'd actually have to go and make that amendment too. It didn't change that they weren't, you know, going to be voting on treaties. They still were able to vote on treaties. They still had to do the advice and consent on judges and appointments and so forth. I mean, all those duties and all their responsibilities, that didn't change. The only thing that changed was how they were to be selected and how they would be to be replaced. It wouldn't go to the state legislatures to do that anymore. That the people would make sure that the U.S. Senate was being occupied to represent their state legislature. There were a lot of states that were just getting, these states aren't doing this. This was a big, huge progressive move, and it was a sleight of hand. because it, like I said, the amendment, if you go through the language, they never talked about the state legislative suffrage that, okay, this is going to change that. That would have been either in the language or at least in the debates, and it didn't. So, again, all the states have to do is they have to go into these source documents and say, we don't care how anybody's interpreting this anymore. This has clearly been laid out. The language never changed our right of suffrage. That is our suffrage. We're demanding that suffrage. And so, as a matter of fact, every state can actually start passing laws that, you know, when a federal person is like a judge, these judges that are, you know, violating the Constitution, making these rulings by interpretation, creating laws and so forth, I'd love to see the attorney generals of all of the states start issuing warrants that if that judge travels through their state, they're to be arrested and they're to be tried for their crimes against the Constitution. This will start waking people up. They may be able to get, you know, the court and the incarceration and so forth and go through all of that. But, you know, and however things work beyond that. But they can arrest, they can start prosecuting and trying, getting convictions, so forth. Whether it goes into appeals and how well the state guards itself to say, I'm sorry, we don't see you having jurisdiction because you're not supporting the Constitution either. Once the demand for full compliance of the Constitution starts proliferating, it's pretty much done for them. They had a good ride. I mean, it's been going 200 years, right? I mean, they've been getting away with murder for a long time. Well, now this is the process. This is the way to do this. And when people actually start putting their foot down, it's the same thing within your state. Your county can actually do these things. Your judge is, you know, here's the problem in your county and here's the problem in the state. Once, you know, you have full agreement, full accord, everybody's on board, then it's easy. But if the sheriff and the county commissioners want to arrest somebody, but the prosecuting attorney and the judge aren't going to, you know, prosecute and try, then they're going to basically release them out of jail. So it's just like an exercise of futility, right? But at least it shows that you did this and you can stand up on the record that this person's violating their oath, they're committing crimes, and we have jurisdiction over the land here. They happen to be in our land. We had these open warrants on them for, you know, calling them out for these crimes. They came here, we arrested. They're not willing to prosecute, that's on them. That's on them. But we're doing what we need to do. And I'll tell you what, when you start doing that, your judge and your prosecuting attorney are going to start tiptoeing like they're walking on eggs, because then everybody will look at them as whether they're violating. So they got to be very, very careful, right? I mean, all of a sudden, it just starts changing. People start really looking over their shoulder. Let's carry this over, because I don't feel like the volition of the discussion has truly gone its full course. Because there's a lot of frustrations with people, but what is it that's going to change things? It requires action. We have to do what's right, and we have to stand up for what is right. I'm G.R. Mobley. We're Reclaiming the Republic, and we need your help. God bless.
If you've listened to my show, Reclaiming the Republic, then you should understand that the Constitution is neither a living document nor a noble guide to governance. In accordance to Article 7, the Constitution is a hard, fast contract, and the states are the only stakeholders in this contract. Integral in contract law, the stakeholders or states possess the inherent authority to exercise oversight and enforcement over their contract. This means they can audit the federal government by the contract, and with republic review, they can enforce compliance to their constitution. Any single state can perform the audit, but when states begin to unite in the auditing process, this is what is referred to as republic review. Please read my argument for republic review, as well as my description of the Republic Review model on ReclaimingTheRepublic.org. We even have a graphic flowchart that shows you how Republic Review works. If you want to learn more, contact me on Facebook or send me an email. Thank you.